It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at a Milwaukee literacy effort to help refugees and immigrants function better as parents, employees, and citizens.
First, from the Black Lives Matter movement to growing concern about racial disparities and educational outcomes, there's been a new wave of activism on issues of concern for African Americans.
But like any social and political movement, generational differences and conflicts can make setting priorities and working toward common goals difficult.
Rahel Tesfamarian is a social activist, public theologian, writer, and speaker. She's the founder and publisher of Urban Cusp, an online magazine focusing on progressive urban culture, faith, and social change. And she'll be speaking tonight on the UW-Madison campus about the intersection between different generations of the civil rights struggle. Rahel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Well, you've said that the Black church used to be kind of the control center of the civil rights movement, if you look back at the 60s, for instance. But today, that's changed. Why is the new generation of civil rights activists moving away from the church?
Right. So my argument wasn't to say that the church has always been the hub of Black liberation. I mean, I think there's always been a connection between the Black struggle for freedom and Black spirituality. But it's more so which platform has the most visibility, the most prominence, and it's not the church. The church is not the visible platform sending the message of liberation that everyone's paying attention to. The marching orders are coming in very organic ways from young people, from women, from the streets. And I think a lot of that just has to do with the fact that young people are fighting for their survival. Young people in Ferguson and Baltimore, working class folks that may not have a college education and may not be validated and legitimized in the eyes of the establishment, but their fight for survival is exactly what gives them legitimacy to be heard and be at the forefront of the movement.
Is there anything about the way that the church has traditionally functions or has functioned that's a part of this? If you look at the way the hierarchy is structured or the fact that it's usually men in the pulpit there, does any of that play into why the Black Lives Matter movement isn't centralized around the church?
Even scripture tells us that the first shall be last and the last shall be first. So it's this idea that we can't ever get too comfortable with hierarchy, we can't get too comfortable with order and status, because in the divine world where the supernatural is always at work, things can be turned upside down overnight. And we've always known that women have been organizing, leading, protesting, resisting. We always have seen that young people are the ones driving the push for social change. That has always been the case. But what happens is that the status quo is maintained even in the fight for liberation. So those that are young get pushed to the back. Those that are middle class, working class, get pushed to the back. But I think that it comes a time when those who are fighting for their liberation understand that they cannot be silent, they cannot be invisible, and the church has to, in many ways, take its marching orders from the ones who are demanding to be heard and seen.
And you've said there's this new urgency that you see in this movement that's going on right now, and that you see more of a parallel to the Black Panthers than, say, to Dr. King's movement. Why the Black Panthers?
Well, there was, of course, SNCC. There was also the Black Panthers, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. There were so many organizations and entities mobilizing during that era. And so people were getting their marching orders from a lot of different sources, some from charismatic leaders, others from more institutional mechanisms. But I honed in on the Black Panther Party because I believe that there is an ideological shift happening in the minds of young people today. And I believe that the Black Panther Party probably reflects a lot of where their ideology is shifting towards, that you have more of this Black nationalist rhetoric, you have more Black nationalist aesthetics, you see it in this passion for natural hair, which has kind of been a wave of the way for quite a while, but now it's more political than it was before. You see it in the T-shirts, the rise of the Black fist again. So a lot of the aesthetics in Black culture are very reflective of the Black power movement. I mean, most recently in Beyonce's performance at the Super Bowl, And so I think there was some of the rhetoric and the ideology and the imagery given to us by the Black Panther Party that wasn't by, say, these other institutions. Now, the strategies of SNCC may be reflective today, but I think the Black Panther Party did a great job of, in some ways, branding liberation and connecting it to what you wore and what you said and how you looked at the world.
You wrote about a protest that was led by the Reverend Al Sharpton sort of in the more early days of the Black Lives Matter movement, and that it was sort of stormed by counter-protesters who wanted to do things a little differently. Do you think that there is a tension between that first generation of Black activists and the generation of new activists that are working and advocating today?
I believe that there's always been a generational tension. Even if you look at the civil rights movement, even in that moment, you see a tension where young people are saying, time is now, and elders are saying, wait your turn. I mean, I can't imagine a moment in history where that tension hasn't existed. I think what's happening now is in many ways a continuation of that same struggle that young people are saying, our time is now. And a lot of the elders in the movement, their passion may still be there for issues of justice, but they're also trying to sustain themselves financially. They're also trying to maintain their livelihood. This is, in many ways, their job. So they're trying to do their job. And in doing their job, may not have taken the time to nurture the next generation of freedom fighters. And so there can oftentimes be a sense of resentment that you want the platform versus teaching me how to have the platform, that you don't honor my voice, you don't respect me, and why should I respect you if you don't respect me? There's without a doubt a generational tension, but there's a class tension. There's a gender tension. You know, there are so many tensions within the movement that oftentimes we focus on the generational one, but there's layers upon layers in which identity politics are playing out and people are vying for space.
We're talking with Rahel Tesfamarian about the role of the Black Church in the new civil rights movement. And looking to the past again, there was a role for what you call, the term is liberation theology, seeing Jesus almost as a politicized figure and using that to springboard off into activism. Do you see that liberation theology as having a role in the new civil rights movement that we're seeing right now?
Everywhere I go, I tell people that there is no Jesus without justice. So it's not a matter of politicizing Jesus. Jesus was political in the sense that Jesus came as a form of rebellion, as a form of resistance, that Jesus in breaking where Jesus was born, what is now known as modern-day Palestine, that Jesus merged Jewish culture with Palestinian identity. I mean, all these things were within themselves inherently messages of liberation, that when he resisted the Roman Empire, when he told people, you know, that you've been excluded and alienated and pushed to the margins, but your faith has made you whole, come into the full circle of life, every single thing that Jesus did, even in the miracles that Jesus performed, these were political acts of resistance. He wouldn't have been killed if what he did wasn't radical and against the Roman Empire. That was ultimately what he was persecuted for, that people were worshiping him and idolizing him as a god in the time in which the empire had been set up to be the only law of the land. And it was this idea that, you know, they saw something in Jesus that they knew they weren't getting from the rulers of their day. And so liberation theology is a continuation of what people have found in Jesus throughout the ages. You know, it's people in Palestine, people in the Caribbean, in Africa, that what was meant to be a tool of oppression has been taken by people who are subjugated and been used for their purposes. You know, and that they have found their own relationship. So it's not a form of theology. My opinion is that liberation theology is the theology of Jesus.
And do you think that's still important to this movement?
Well, I find that many young people, many millennials today are not having the same relationship with Jesus, with God, with Allah, with whatever you want to call it. Oftentimes you find that this can in some ways be an a-religious, a-spiritual movement. Part of it is when you really take on the ideology of Black resistance, Black nationalism, and Black radical thought, it often will unveil to you all the ways in which Christianity has been a tool of oppression. What I think is important is for young people to reclaim faith and spirituality. It may not lead you to Christianity, which is where it led me. You may not get there. You may get somewhere very different, but I think that journey is important. Why? Because you need every tool at your disposal. Why give up on the possibility of having faith and spirituality as just another arsenal in your belt? I mean, we need everything, because part of it is faith propels us to the supernatural, to see the world as it should be, not just as it is. And I think that's a powerful mechanism for this generation.
Now, Dr. Martin Luther King, he's celebrated today, revered for his vision, his nonviolence, his passion from the pulpit, and having that sort of crossover between his work as a reverend and as a civil rights leader. Do activists today still talk about him as a role model?
I think Dr. King is going to be an icon, a source of inspiration, a hero, a role model for generations to come. I don't think that there is a young black child growing up in America or anywhere in the world, and at any point in soon-to-be history, that will not be deeply inspired and moved by the legacy of Dr. King, not just because he understood the power of life and death is in the tongue, and he used his words for life, not only because he was willing to sacrifice everything, his personal time, his body, that he sacrificed his life. Many of us are humbled by the fact that regardless of the sacrifices we are willing to make for the black community, we're still alive. And so when you look at a Dr. King, when you look at a Malcolm X, when you think of a Fred Hampton, you think of people who ultimately lost the most precious gift that we have, which is the gift of life, in pursuit of liberation. And so there's a humility that the fact that this man was not able to be a father for the remainder of his children's lives, you know, that he wasn't able to enjoy the riches of being a grandfather. Like, these are things that I think will always make him a source of humility for my generation.
Rahel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Rahel Tesfamarian, a social activist, public theologian, writer, and speaker, and she'll be giving a lecture on the UW-Madison campus tonight. The talk is free and open to the public. There's information about it up on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we look at literacy efforts geared toward immigrants and refugees in Wisconsin. It's time for Wisconsin Life, and all this week, our look at literacy here in the state. Miss Elizabeth escaped Liberia during its brutal Civil War. Her son helped her settle in Milwaukee, where she went to school for the first time in her life. She's since become an American citizen and continues to work on her English.
My name is Masita Swale from Africa.
But she goes by Miss Elizabeth. Miss Elizabeth came to Milwaukee from Liberia in 2007. She knew no English. She'd never even really gone to school.
Well, I didn't go to school, but I go to Arabic school. Mm-hmm. My father sent me to Arabic school. I was there for 2 years. I wanted to go to school, but my father didn't agree to that. So he said, no, he said, I can't go to English school.
Her father, she says, didn't understand the importance of an education.
And my father was a farmer. He took me to the farm. There were our air until I was 16 years. Then I got married. I had 8 children.
Then Civil War came to Liberia.
When the war came, 1989, at the time the war came, the rebel war came. So we're in Monrovia. We're there now, we're confused. We don't know where to go. At the same time, they're killing the people. The rebel then killing the people. Our people then dead. They kill a lot of our people there.
More than 200,000 people would die in the war. Tens of thousands fled the country.
Because we had 16 tribes in Liberia. 16 tribes. That the Mandingo people, the rebel then were killing them. Killing them, killing them. So we were confused. We don't know where to go. Yeah, we really suffer.
But then, one of Miss Elizabeth's sons secured refuge in Milwaukee. He later sent for the rest of his family. He also helped his mother learn English.
Soon I will come. My son told me, he said, Ma, he said they have school here for old people. So I want for you to go there so you can learn how to write your name down, how to learn English. I said, okay. He sent me here.
She's come a long way.
When I come here newly, really, I will not know how to write my name down. And from 1, 2, 3 to 100, I will not know that. And from January to December, I will not know. So they teach me all that one.
Miss Elizabeth is happy to be in Milwaukee.
I love America. Really, I love America. I like because of the freedom. Yeah. I'm free in the country here. My children are free. Everyone are all happy. Yeah. I like Liberia, but America, I really want to stay here now. Yeah.
Miss Elizabeth is a Liberian refugee who now lives in Milwaukee. She shared her story as part of this week's look at literacy in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Get more info at wisconsinlife.org.
Now we'll check in on efforts to help immigrants and refugees to function effectively as parents, employees, and citizens through literacy. Cynthia Zarazua is the instructional supervisor at the International Learning Center, a program of Neighborhood House in Milwaukee, and she's here with us now. Cynthia, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Well, so can you tell us a little bit about the kinds of things that you do at the International Learning Center in Milwaukee?
Certainly. First and foremost, we have a lot of fun. And we do that by teaching English to refugees, citizenship and civics instruction, math, and computer skills to our students.
And how many people are you working with right now?
Well, on a yearly basis, we work with around 600 refugees.
And what are the main types of literacy that immigrants need to learn as soon as possible, the things that have urgency to make a new life here?
Well, certainly the language, so that they can gain employment. All of the four programs I shared with you have the common mission of enabling them to function, as you said, effectively as parents, workers, and citizens. But first and foremost is a job, obtaining the job.
And I wonder, is it mostly about the reading and writing skills, or are there cultural literacy schools? I imagine if I were suddenly to up stakes and move to another country, language would be part but not all of what I needed to settle in.
Yes. Refugees, when they arrive in the country, go through a cultural orientation class. We at ILC do not provide that class, but the resettlement agencies in town do. And that class enables them to get a bit more of an understanding of the American culture.
What kinds of stories have you heard from people about what they've been through and what brought them here?
Well, most of our students are here because they have arrived from a war-torn country. The definition of a refugee is someone who flees their country due to war, political or religious persecution, drought, famine. And the bulk of our students are here because they come from a country at war and have spent time in refugee camps.
Well, I imagine you have people coming through not just dealing with getting used to a new language and a new culture, but dealing with trauma from that war or other horrific experience that led them to be a refugee in the first place.
And you're very right. Many of our students have been traumatized in a number of areas. Certainly living in that conflict causes trauma, but also some of them come with physical impairments that they obtained due to the war. We have about five students with us who are blind, and so that certainly compounds the trauma.
You said that first and foremost you have fun, and it sounds like you're working with people who may not have had fun in a long time. What kinds of things do you do to build a community?
Well, I must give credit to our students. They are very good community builders, and one thing we do is provide a nice, warm, comfortable, and safe place for them to come and learn and relax. As you can imagine, the pressures that they may feel not in the center where they have many people like themselves with similar backgrounds, but also people who understand their situation, who are extremely willing to help them and extend assistance in any litany of ways that that help them improve their lives.
And Cynthia, briefly, as we wrap up, what do these newcomers to Wisconsin think of our state? What's the first thing they ask you about?
Generally, it's the weather. But they like Wisconsin very much. Our students, the human spirit is very resilient. They are energetic. They're optimistic. They are grateful. And they enjoy, as Miss Elizabeth said, the freedom and the opportunities that our country provides them.
Well, Cynthia, thanks so much for sharing their stories with us.
Thank you, Robin and Veronica.
That's Cynthia Zarazua. She's instructional supervisor at the International Learning Center, a program of Neighborhood House Milwaukee. This is part of a week-long Wisconsin Life series focusing on literacy in Wisconsin. You can hear more on Morning Edition at 6:30 and 8:30 a.m., Central Time at 4:15 each day, or archived at WPR.org. Today's Day Without Latinos rally drew a big crowd to the Capitol to protest legislation that organizers say unfairly targets immigrants in the state. WPR reporter Parth Shah was there. He joins us now in the studio to set the scene. Parth, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about the crowd. How big?
So it was pretty big. Reports are now saying that there were upwards of 20,000 people there. Actually, at the other end of State Street, you could hear the chants of "Si se puede," "Yes, we can." You could hear that all the way from the other side. When you get to the crowd, you would see it's a sea of people out there. A lot of people were actually wearing orange monarch butterfly wings. The monarch butterfly has kind of become a symbol for the immigrant rights movement because monarch butterflies migrate from Canada to Mexico. So that was pretty cool to see. A lot of different signs and banners out there. The most common one by far was a sign that said, Wisconsin is not Arizona, and hashtag Wisconsin is not Arizona, comparing the Badger State to Arizona, which has been in the hot seat for similar legislation in the past.
And demographics, so what did you make of the age range of the crowd, at least the portion you were able to see?
And that was really cool that there was a huge diversity in the age range. I was standing next to some high school students from Monona that were there, and you could tell they weren't as informed with the intricacies of the bills that were being passed, but they were here to support. Some of them said they had family members that would be affected by legislation if it passed. I spoke to some parents out there that pulled out their kids for the day from school, and they also took off from work that day to be out there and voice their opinion and, you know, stand in support of their community.
And we've heard from some of the legislators backing this legislation. After five, we'll hear from one of the organizers of the protest today. But what were some of the main messages you were hearing at the rally, Parth?
I think the main general message was of Latino pride. I mean, Hispanics make up 6% of the state population, but they play a huge role in various industries in the state. We know the dairy industry in particular. So there was definitely a feeling that, hey, we're here. We are a huge part of the economic engine here. Value us, and we're going to stand up for our rights and, not let legislation that they believe would jeopardize their livelihoods here pass.
Parth, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
It's glad to be here. Thank you.
That's WPR reporter Parth Shah talking about today's Day Without Latinos rally at the state capitol. We'll hear, as I said, from an organizer of those protests coming up after 5.
The U.S. company Apple is continuing to oppose a judge's order to help the FBI hack into the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooters. Apple CEO Tim Cook called the order an overreach by the U.S. government.
Joining us now to discuss the issue is Ruthann Robson, law professor from the City University of New York. Ruthann, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me.
Well, first things first, what, as we understand it, is the FBI asking Apple to do with the iPhone used by one of the shooters in that San Bernardino terrorist attack?
Well, it's somewhat complicated, but the FBI, through the U.S. attorney, filed a motion, and I've read the motion. It's about 40 pages or so, and kind of explaining the technology. And basically what they're asking Apple to do is to kind of break into the phone in a certain way to allow the FBI to then break into it using the passcode, right? So their problem is, and we've all seen this on our phones, right? You can have a passcode on your phone, either four digits or six digits, and six is obviously more complicated. And what's happened with the new iPhones or the newer iPhones is that if you enter the passcode wrong, I think it's 10 times, then the phone basically shuts down. And there are arguments of, does it really erase the data? Does it not? Does it, you know, those kinds of things. So the FBI can't use some kind of, you know, method to just run a lot of passcodes and get into it. And so what they're asking, what the government is asking Apple to do is to kind of write code so that that will be disabled. And it's the same kind of thing, you know, we've all had this experience if you have an iPhone where they do updates. So they're basically asking Apple to do some kind of new update, write code for that, and disenable that security feature.
So, right, they want Apple to, in effect, trick its own phone, say, okay, here's an official update phone, and that's going to let the FBI do this bulk attempt to break the password. Now, the FBI is saying, we're just going to do it with this one phone. Apple is resisting now, and their case is saying, hey, once we give the FBI the ability to do this, there's no way we can stop them from doing it to only this one phone. They could do it to any phone, that any of our phones that they want. Is that right?
Yes, and I think Apple's argument is even broader. I think one of the things that they're saying is once we write this code, then we don't even know that it would be limited to the government, that any hacker could get it or any other country could get it, or we'd have to do it for other countries as well. And I think that's sort of implied in many of the things that they're saying.
Yeah, Apple. Apple CEO Tim Cook put out a press release, a public letter, basically to the users of their phones, saying, in effect, we don't want to create this vulnerability here. So this is an interesting legal issue. There's obviously a terrorist case. There's an interest in knowing what the shooter was doing before this attack. On the other hand, there's an interest in protecting privacy from surveillance. We're going to be hearing a lot more arguments like this, not just over this one phone, aren't we?
Absolutely. And one of the sort of background issues is that Congress has been considering legislation to not allow Apple and other companies to even have these security measures in phones, or if they have these security measures in phones, that the government has to be able to have the codes or things like that. So there's legislation that's kind of been, it's not really pending yet, but it's been proposed and talked about. So that's kind of back there as well.
We're talking to law professor Ruth Ann Robson from the City University of New York, looking at this ongoing case. The FBI wants Apple to give it the keys to unlock a particular phone, a particular iPhone used by one of the shooters in the San Bernardino, California terrorist attack. Apple says, no, that's going to endanger the security of our phones if we do this for all of our customers. Well, just before all of this came out, last week, Apple CEO Tim Cook was speaking at a White House-organized cybersecurity summit. Last week, I want to give a little listen to what he had to say.
People have entrusted us with their most personal and precious information. We owe them nothing less than the best protections that we can possibly provide. By harnessing the technology at our disposal and working together as businesses, governments, and citizens, we believe we can bring about a future that fully embraces both privacy and security.
Well, there he's talking about government and businesses working together to build this trust. And now, after all this week, he's saying the government is asking his corporation to undo that trust, is his concern, that customers won't be able to trust the companies with their data, with providing them with secure devices. Do you think that's a big concern for Apple and other corporations that make phones and tablets and computers?
Yes, I do. But I'd like to put a little bit of a cynical spin on it, if I could. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of from the individual's perspective, that the government has an interest in security, right? That our government should keep us secure. And the company has an interest in profits, and that's kind of the cynical part, right? And us as individuals have an interest in our privacy. And sometimes our privacy sort of aligns with profits, sometimes with security, sometimes with the government, sometimes, you know, it can be all over the place. But I think that we shouldn't kind of mistake Apple or other corporations being solely interested in our privacy, because, of course, they use a lot of our data and sell it in other contexts.
And on the security issue, how much of an exception is there to usual rules of privacy and confidentiality when it comes to an active investigation of something like a terrorist attack like this?
So I think one thing that factually is kind of interesting is that the phone actually belonged to the state government. It was the person's work phone, so there's that. And the other issue for me is that when we talk about terrorism and, you know, kind of active shooter, I mean, this person has been dead for some time now. And yes, they're investigating, but we sort of don't have one of those classic emergencies mm-hmm. where people are being held hostage or there's something like this where we need the information right away because there's an impending terrorist attack. Now, I understand that the government wants to prevent other terrorist attacks or other kinds of attacks and security and things like that, but it's kind of not quite the immediacy that the government is saying it. And in terms of other investigations, I'm here in New York, and our mayor this morning was saying, yes, this would be a great thing for law enforcement to have because there are so many phones that we have that we can't get into. So I think that the kind of classic slippery slope of using it in all kinds of investigations is pretty obvious.
Now, some people are thinking of this as a Fourth Amendment issue regarding illegal search and seizure. How does the Fourth Amendment play into this discussion?
So I think, most technically, it's a Fourth Amendment issue, but I'd also kind of like to bring in the First Amendment as well in terms of our freedom of association and kind of a general privacy. But it's definitely a Fourth Amendment issue. There's a search warrant, and that's how they got the phone through the execution of a search warrant. And the search warrant goes further to say, yes, and we want all the information in the phone. So they have a warrant, which was issued on probable cause, and assuming that that's reasonable, which it seems to be, the Fourth Amendment privacy right then kind of yields to a magistrate saying, yes, this would be a reasonable search and seizure. So the Fourth Amendment has that word reasonable in it. The First Amendment is really about, you know, protecting free speech, free association, freedom of expression. And sometimes in surveillance, the First Amendment could be a little bit more effective than the Fourth Amendment.
We're talking right now with City University of New York Professor Ruthann Robson about the standoff between Apple and the FBI on issues of cybersecurity and privacy.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you think that Apple should comply with the government's request on issues of national security? Should other companies that hold our private information do that too? Or do you think the government is going too far in that request? Does it violate the privacy of citizens? Call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion about the battle between privacy and security in the very public dispute between the FBI and Apple. Apple is continuing to oppose a judge's order to help the FBI hack into the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooters. Apple CEO Tim Cook called the order an overreach by the U.S. government in an open letter that we have posted on the Facebook page.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the FBI is right? Apple's right? Maybe a little of both? Where do we draw the line? Call 800-642-1234. Ruthann Robson stays with us, law professor at City University of New York. We'll get to our callers in just a moment. But Ruthann, I wonder, the FBI wants this to happen. A magistrate, as you said, says, yes, Apple, you have to do this. Apple has said no. So what's next? Can they be compelled? Is Tim Cook going to be, I don't know, in jail and contempt of court? What happens?
I think it will take quite a number of proceedings before that happens. But one thing that's important to remember is that the actual motion was ex parte, meaning Apple was not part of it. The judge issued the order, and actually kind of just crossed off proposed because it was sent from the U.S. attorney and just then signed her name. So at this point in the court, it's not really joined so much. And the other is that there are some kind of almost non-constitutional, non-big picture issues, one of which is, and it's a test from a case from 1977, the New York telephone case, which tells you one thing, that we have all these old cases being applied to new technology, which is a little scary and always a problem. But one of the criteria is that the order does not place an unreasonable burden on the person to comply, here Apple. And so part of the argument, I think, will be this kind of almost technical argument about, is this an unreasonable burden or not? So Apple is kind of positioning themselves as saying, this will mean that we will have to write all this new code. And the U.S. attorney is saying, you know, code is what Apple does all the time, and they can do this, you know, fairly quickly. Of course, it does seem like the FBI can't write the code, and we could think that they're just kind of not up to speed. On the other hand, a lot of what's happening is proprietary, or a lot of what's involved is proprietary information. It seems like the government just does not have the information that they would need to write the code.
We'll bring in our callers now. We've got Eric on the line in Cedarburg. Eric, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think that if they can't figure it out without a cell phone, they're not qualified.
The FBI.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, they're going to compromise everyone's security because they can't figure it out?
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. So, yeah, that's basically the argument Apple is making, that providing this to the FBI ultimately endangers everyone's privacy and security on their phones. Is that something that would be factored in, Ruthann, in that argument over whether this is a reasonable request?
Yes, I think exactly that. And what the government is arguing is that they can't figure it out, not because they don't have the technical expertise, although they're not saying that. I'm kind of saying that for them, but that the encryption is proprietary, so they don't sort of have the knowledge, because it's kind of secret knowledge of how these things are set up, so they don't know kind of what code they would be writing to change what code that they would be trying to change, because they don't have that underlying information.
Eric, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Jonah in Whitewater. Jonah, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jonah?
I actually wanted to speak on the unreasonable burden that was just brought up, because one thing that hasn't been touched on is a big part of Apple's business is contracts with companies where they use their phones because they're secure. And for them to make a backdoor or exploit to unlock phones would essentially prove that, you know, possibly another group could do the same thing. So they could end up losing a lot of business from not having these contracts, because it would essentially prove that their phones aren't as secure as they say.
Interesting idea, Jonah. So I wonder, again, with that reasonability standard, Ruthann, could Apple successfully make an argument that doing this would unduly affect their business? It would cost them a ton of money. Is a court hearing that gonna care?
Possibly, because part of the unreasonable burden criteria is that the company, or that the person who has to comply, here Apple, is entitled to reasonable reimbursement for that effort. Now, obviously, it seems as if they're just saying, like, the cost of writing the code here. But Apple could argue that reasonable reimbursement has to be not just for that effort, but kind of what it would cost them in lost profit. And again, this particular phone was purchased by California and given to the person as a state employee, and the California agencies were the entities that actually enabled some of these security features.
Talking to law professor Ruth Ann Robson from the City University of New York, looking at this case, a bit of a standoff now between the FBI and the company Apple. FBI wants Apple to give them the tools they need to unlock a phone belonging to one of the San Bernardino shooters. We heard from a Chris on Facebook who says, why don't they just give Apple the phone, have them unlock it, and then give it back to the FBI? So is there maybe a compromise solution where Apple could do the job internally, not put this new code, I guess, in the hands of the FBI?
I think it's possible, and part of the order actually says, or other means that both parties find acceptable. So there might be some compromises here. Kind of technically, I'm not sure whether that's possible or whether Apple is going to say, no, just kind of writing the code means that. But or, you know, would kind of release the code like a genie from a bottle, and then everyone would have it. But it does seem like that there could be other kinds of compromises here, certainly.
Ruthann, you mentioned earlier that we're using laws from our old-fashioned landline phone systems in some cases. I believe there's a law from 1789 that's part of this order, going back, of course, to the Constitution we mentioned already. Have we caught up with the modern age of communication technology when it comes to our legal system?
No, is the short answer. The 1789 law and the All Writs Act, right, so those are about jurisdiction and what court should hear what and how things should go. And I think to some degree those are antiquated, but to another degree, you know, they're not so much. They're about process and power and the relationships between governments. But when it comes to actual getting evidence or getting documents or getting information, right? So we're in the information age. Those things have changed. And one of the things that was true in the New York Telephone Company case, which everyone is, or the government is relying on from 1977, one of the things that they talked about was that the telephone company, after all, was a public utility. That seems a long time ago.
Yeah, Apple is not such.
And neither is our phone companies anymore.
So is this a thing where you think, I don't know, legislators need to be trying to update laws, or is it something that gets worked out in the courts? And even if they do, are we going to have a whole new communication infrastructure by the time they do get caught up?
I think it's going to be a long process, and we've seen this problem with trying to regulate the internet and regulate items of the information age quite a bit. I think the first kind of cases were around, you know, obscenity and pornography, some of which the United States Supreme Court struck down, some finally which were upheld. But I think we're kind of in new territory, and the laws really haven't been passed that accommodate this new technology. And even if they do, the technology is moving quite quickly.
We'll leave it there for now. Ruthann, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.